thank you for coming. I always appreciate you coming, especially in a somewhat difficult subject for everybody. I told my wife that this is like me teaching you Russian when I don't know Russian. And it also reminds me that I really need some more work in knowable stuff in this ancient history that I was paying no attention to when I was in college, probably never had any of it. So we're trying to build a lot of, catch up a lot of stuff here. And anyway, we need to do some work at this, but just a couple of more preliminary remarks about today or our lesson. We have one or two lessons left, and I'll tell you next week which it is. One side of me says I've got too much material, or I don't have interesting material, or I got material I can't deal with. And then I said, well, I got some stuff we can deal with. So I don't know what it's going to be. So one or two lessons. I did make contact with two people this last week. Steve Brown, who is part of Shasta Bible College, or I'll probably call him university now, in Redding, California, who is mentioned as a person in the books to contact regarding ordering and stuff. And also George Gunn. I know him from Shasta. He comes to a free trip conference every year. And I thought, well, at least I got a contact with him. So I talked to him first, not intentionally, but just happened to be. And so he encouraged me with Dr. Pilkey, by the way, is what we're talking about, and his authorship and his scholarship and his credibility. And then I talked to Steve Brown for quite a while, and he's on leave right now at the school from health issues, and taught Pilkey's material in a college-level class. And he said, a lot of things I've told you, hard to understand, kind of elitist approach to knowledge. And he says in his class, it really wasn't a class he lectured in. He did put up a big piece of paper on the wall, and then everybody contributed to the paper. Well, that's just about the way it is. Everybody's done his little thing trying to make sense of what he has said. But I do have to admit, after reading his stuff a lot, and some of it reading 3, 4, 5, 6 times, and then putting it back into my own words, then reading his stuff, that's, oh, I know now what he means. Follow that. If I can put it in my words, then read it back into his. But it's really hard to tease out that stuff. So he is still living. He apparently had a stroke about 12 years ago, and he's not functioning in terms of writing and stuff. So what else? I'll probably say some things about him that Steve Brown mentioned to me. I was just a little assuring that I could find somebody that knew him and had used his material. And only other thing he told me was encouraging that all the material that Pilkey has developed, which are 6 books, and there's papers that are never published and so forth, they have been all given to ICR as well as Answers in Genesis. And they were fairly cool to it at first, he said, but there seemed to be warming up and picking up some of the theories or some of the ideas that Pilkey had, which I told you that unless ICR Answers in Genesis pick this up, it's not going to go anywhere. So I'm really hoping in the years to come, if the Lord tarries, that that will happen. So objective in the remaining weeks, I guess in your mind, I just want you to expand the possibilities of this ancient time that we know little or nothing about in the Bible. The Bible gives us a skeleton, I call it, that the flesh is missing. And the flesh is assumed that you know it. And we talked about why science discouraged investigation of that. So we have a generation that are ignorant about this stuff. So what to expect from the study? Basically a framework idea that you know there's something back there. Don't know much about it, but probably something you could study if you want to do someday. And it has some answers to some of the problems or questions we've had. And most of all, it puts all the world history into some kind of unified framework. Instead of having the Egyptians off on the side, not knowing where they were, the Chaldeans somewhere, we don't know where they are, whoever, but they all fit together somehow. And we can do that because we have the Bible as a basis for it. And we know the Bible is right. So we don't need to change the Bible to make it fit the world. The world has to fit to meet the Bible. So the framework is what I'm interested for you and for me. And this is really going on a limb. If there's any of you souls out there that are brave that like to study this, you know, on a smaller group basis or a private group, however you want to do it further, I'd be interested to know who you are, and maybe we can do something about it. Maybe we put our big piece of paper on the wall, we can all contribute to it. Now, I promised you last week I was going to do a section on marital ethics. Remember, Noah fathers of many children that are not listed in this, not obviously listed in Scripture. And that gives us some angst because we have a, you know, relatively pristine view of family life and one man, one woman, and so forth. Anything else out of that is immoral. But I've got a lesson that I was wondering to bring it today, but it would be half of this lesson. And so I left it and I thought, well, I'm going to see if there's any interest in doing that because if I do it 2 weeks, I'll probably have to use that. And since it is somewhat of a, not sensitive, it is not somewhat a sensitive issue. It is a sensitive issue. And, but if you don't deal with it, you can't solve it. So, and to that extent, it's an important issue. And if you have difficulty, and I think probably we all do, I have trouble with it. I have a lot of moral angst over this, trying to work it out, but I think I have. And so I'll do that either next week or I don't want to do it the last week. I better do it next week. Try to make the last week kind of a funner, more fun week. I hope. And then I'll tell you why the pyramids were built in the last 5 minutes of our class. So, all right, that's kind of where we're going. And that takes 6 minutes. I probably have too much material today. I don't know. We'll see. Always have too much or too little. So this short series examines the post-flood world. I'm using the date of the flood, 2518. It may not be right, but you got to stay consistent with one guy's dates, and that's what I'm doing. And the Bible gives us this history in Genesis 9 and 11, particularly. It is a skeletal treatment of an immensely, immensely complicated subject, not because the subject is complicated, but because we're so ignorant of it. I mean, if somebody didn't know anything about American history and they dropped in and you start talking about American history, and say, oh, it's terribly complicated. Well, yeah, we have a little background of it. We maybe can remember the first president and maybe the president that freed the slaves and maybe the president or the last. So we know a little bit about it, but if we knew nothing about it, it would seem complicated. So I don't mean it's complicated because it's just complicated. It's just complicated because it's history, which you know a little about. And then we mentioned the science discouraged any serious investigation of ancient histories that could shed light on this period because they were considered myths. It is as if science said to the Roman Empire that the Roman Empire was a myth and no one would study it for historic value, then we would know nothing about the Roman Empire, as an example. That's changing a little bit. So we mentioned that the sleight of hand put the Bible into the myth category, thus unworthy of serious consideration. Ostensibly, all ancient accounts are mythological. Bible, all the others too. So that gave us our dark tunnel. The last 150 years have been bleak. However, discoveries continue to be made that are about histories from this period. The recovery began when Genesis flood became a real event. Now, if you grew up in a conservative church, it never lost its value, historic value. But in the value of even Bible scholars that were translating the Bibles for us, like Schofield and even guys like J. Vernon McGee, they built a lot of time into their Bibles. So I wasn't subject to that. I grew up with the idea that there was a flood. I never questioned it. And then when I found out that others did, I was a little surprised. And that was when Gil came and told me about the Genesis flood, how that was such a groundbreaking, fresh look at things. And I thought, well, it's just the same old, same old. But, you know, obviously he does a scholarly work with it. So the real event of the Genesis flood by Whitcomb and Morris, published around 59 to 60, I forget what the date is. So now, in addition, we have access to the writings of John Pilkey, who started around 1962. I think he is my age, so that's when I graduated from college. And he had some advanced degrees, which I never went for. And to study these ancient records, and he spent his lifetime, really an advocation, because he was an English teacher by trade at the Master's College in Hall Hill, New Hall in California. So these ancient records are identified as corresponding to people and places that events in the Bible. And I say, now we're getting somewhere if somebody can do that. So he's published 6 books on the subject, The First Origin of the Nations in 1984. And I would say he has no peer. And that's what I got from Dr. Steve Brown. He has no peer. No one can compete with him. He said he's probably the most brilliant person that he's ever known. And now that puts you at a disadvantage because sometimes they can talk above you, and I guess that's just exactly what's happening. he doesn't realize how it is, and he sort of had, not tell this privately, I guess, sort of had this attitude. Well, if you can't tough language, then don't read my stuff. You know, it's kind of like that kind of thing. So, but don't do that to us. Oh, so because of ignorance of this period, it is difficult to sort out the true history through his writing. I read stuff again and again and again. Okay, we are no position to judge him or his conclusion. That's the thing that's really kind of scary about this. I remember talking to Charlie Clough, who knows John Pilkey, was in school with him. And I know on this tape he would cite John Pilkey's work, and he says, I have no ability to judge his work. In other words, you've got to know more about what Pilkey knows than what Pilkey knows to judge him. And Clough is no, as they call it in German, Schlunz. He knows his stuff, very bright, but he couldn't say. So he almost had to take Pilkey the way I'm doing it for what he says and assuming that is right. Now, what we have with Pilkey is at least a believer, evangelical, dispensational person, taught at Master's College, which came out of the GRBC school, churches, a Dallas-trained school as well. So I wouldn't ever use him if it was anybody else. So anyway, I have a little bit of confidence that maybe something he says might be true. Also realize that, according to Steve Brown, that he's changed some of his views on things, and that drives him crazy. So you read something in early books and it's changed in the later books. That doesn't help much. So like I say, this is a very, very green subject yet. And maybe someday it'll come to more maturity. Maybe in glory. So we are no position to judge him or his conclusions. So I'm going to take him for at his word, knowing who he is, and trust him as well as can anybody else. So in Genesis 9 through 11 is the skeleton, as if the missing flesh was assumed to be known by the former generations, but lost to ours. It's interesting that John Wesley, a fan of Jacob Bryant, a scholar of his own time. Now, Jacob Bryant would be the last Pilkey we had writing this way. I've used his name before, Jacob Bryant. And John Wesley thought he was the scholar at his time. So that's something that helps a little bit too. And Pilkey says, I'm in the form of Jacob Bryant. All right, so an older guy that we could refer to, that from him there's sort of this gap that has existed. So we begin only as an introduction to the material, and that it does exist. And we know the Noahic mandate, God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be multiply, be fruitful and multiply, which means a great population, and fill, that is imperatively fill, the earth full. And again, we have the same chapter, a few verses later, be fruitful and multiply, abound, the word swarm on the earth and multiply. Now, obviously, Noah didn't have that many children, but it's set up so that can happen. And so it doesn't happen in a pile somewhere in Mesopotamia and America's getting no people. It's set up so that the whole world has a population by the time we get to Abraham. Now, all this civilization did not survive as equally as others did, okay? Especially in America's. So Genesis also records God's promise that the world would never be destroyed by floodwaters, and Noah's son must populate the earth. Those two things. This shows that they led in the operation, although many others' descendants assisted to accomplish it. It wasn't just Noah and his sons. There were others who were born to this family that actually probably grew to probably about 53 or 54 inside, that became what he called the Noahic elite that basically ran the program to populate the earth. We mentioned others since it appears that Noah had other children after the flood. Now that might give some of us angst right there. But Noah wouldn't necessarily sit aside and say, not more children for me. I have got three boys. That's not enough. Not necessarily. He was a young man yet at 600, and he lived 350 more years, and he did have more children. In fact, the Bible, I think, says that. These are the descendants of Noah's sons. Now, careful how you read this. These are the descendants of Noah's sons, Shem, Ham, Japheth, and children were born to them. Who's the them? Just the last three? Not necessarily. Apparently not. Because sons and daughters were born to them, all of them. The expression could mean only the sons, last sons, but better, it states that Noah sired more children. And the eternal and external information supports that fact. I call it a fact, theory, whatever. We also determined that God gave Noah an order. This is not a suggestion. If you have time, would you please? No, do it, Noah. In order to fill the earth abundantly with swarming people to a great population. And I just say, look around, and I ask one question. Did Noah succeed? Yes, he did. I guess you don't want to say something too obvious, because you might look too smart. So look around. You see it fully occupied earth. Noah accomplished it. And it's pretty well uniformly scattered, isn't it? From this, we determine that Noah obeyed some methodical way to accomplish it. Now, Noah lived 350 years after the flood, was able to see the skeletal task carried out. I'm not sure. I'll just look this up a little bit here, but he died in 2968, supposedly, the date. And I think that's around Abraham's time. So we might say up to Abraham's time. Noah does not overlap Abraham. Shem does, but not Abraham. In fact, Shem outlives Abraham. So Genesis gives us the positive mandate to fill the earth, but it also gives us the great impediment that changed the unified project into an effort fraught with conflict and trouble. It is axiomatic that a little misstep can lead to broad consequences. Remember the assassination of Archduke of Austria in Sarajevo in 1914 sparked the deadly, brutal trench warfare of World War I that killed 10 million people, all told. Now, some might have said it was a small thing that the assassin was conceived in a mother's womb sometime. That was a pretty small thing, wasn't it? Not really. Noah's failure, a misstep, a normal event, question marks. Or was Noah a drunk? Here in simple terms, we have Noah at his worst. A righteous man, but apparently in love with the fruit of the vine. Of all things that he could have said about Noah, that could be said about Noah, his proclivity for wine is what is recorded, because out of his sinful indulgence, the enemy of the soul found a way to disrupt his plan. We need not speculate here. Genesis 29:20 says that Noah planted a vineyard. Do you suppose he intended to have wine? That took a while to grow that thing, yeah. His encounter with wine was then not an accident. It may have been a common occurrence. We do not know. However, you probably don't find it drunk once, do you? True, wine was the common drink of the day, but drunkenness need not be. Lots of warnings about that. Whatever Noah's culpability was, it was on this occasion that his youngest son, Ham, takes the opportunity to discredit Noah. There are suggestions that there was more to the account than a chance discovery of drunken, naked Noah, that Ham might have suggested something nefarious about Noah, but it matters not. We leave it as is, an unfortunate incident that changed the world's history. This event affected everyone, including us. The sinful act of Ham divides the repopulation effort that is further fueled by the Tower of Babel incident. It's kind of like a rocket. You got the first stage and you got the second stage. Both do the same thing, but they do it in the wrong direction. So we have these two events, one small and unseen, privately, unseen to the population, the other large and overwhelming. These two incidents are in the Bible because of their seminal beginning historic value, which explains bad things in the world. Yet in spite of the challenges presented by sinful conduct, the world is zoned, in spite of it, the world is zoned and completely marked off by seed families by the time of Abraham. The incident with Ham could likely have gone unmentioned. It almost seems, why is this even mentioned? However, of necessity, or just in Noah's mind, or Noah's eyes, Noah reacts with a smothering curse on Ham. Now, our question is, was this God's directive or permissive will? Remember that little chart from last week? Did God want him to do this, or is this something that Noah did? Without God's directive will. Obviously, he permitted it. Now, Noah exhibits some autonomy here. God did not tell Noah to curse his son. I don't think it says that in the Bible. Well, it was his sovereign will, God's sovereign will, but he allowed it to happen. But God didn't tell him to do it. But the curse actually falls on Ham's son, Canaan. Now, speculation about about cursing Ham's son, Canaan, and not Ham are not settled until tonight. However, it was Noah's plan to settle the earth with his three sons, he and his three sons. Cutting Ham out of the plan would defeat one-third, let's say, of his plan. That's unacceptable. Now you understand why he couldn't curse Ham. Therefore, cursing the son, Canaan, allows Ham his one-third place in the project, and he is diminished by the loss of Canaan, a great loss. So what is striking is God's hands-off approach to this whole thing to me. So God's silence may not be surprising. No record of Noah asking advice. Is Noah held so high in our moral panoply of that he cannot do any wrong? Sometimes we do this with our leaders. Therefore, Noah's actions are God's directive, will? Perhaps not. Yes, he was righteous. Remember, he was not perfect. So God allows, apparently, this incident by his sovereign will. We want peace and harmony for Noah on the earth. Really want it, really want it. Why can't we have peace and harmony on earth? And we're really saddened to see it go. So God will allow extreme division, unrest in the world to thwart the enemy. I mean, it works both ways. The knife cuts both ways. The enemy causes trouble, and God causes trouble for the enemy. So God will allow extreme division, unrest in the world to thwart the enemy and to teach us the lesson that with the enemy, there is no peace. And that is a hard point to press, that God allows turmoil in the world. Well, the lesson is we wait for his peace and his King of peace. It will not come otherwise. Satan in Ham and Nimrod attempt to establish the first utopia, Babel style. It will be stopped by God, not Noah. Noah doesn't run it. Hey, stop, stop. No, God stopped it. Obviously, God had plans to use Noah's shortfall to divide the world into tiny pieces. Our peace plans cannot offset God's war plans. Remember, God is on the warpath. Fallen humanity cannot manage peaceful political unity because it will turn on God. Repeat that. Fallen humanity cannot manage peaceful political unity because it will turn on God. Exhibit the USA. Well, we're getting ahead of the Babel account. In fact, we may not even deal with it particularly. Fairly familiar. We could say some things we'll see, but I don't have any more of it but tonight. But it is interesting that the only nation in history that there has been a melting pot of people, races, and family, sometimes called exceptionalism or the Great Experiment, is our country. It has functioned entirely as an immigrant nation that has founded and united around the Christian goal of establishing a free peopled, where everyone was considered to be equal before God and the law. The Constitution did ring out slavery in less than 100 years with a deadly war. Slavery would have disappeared for economic reasons in just a few more decades. What a loss. But slavery was gone. Just now, when progress and achievements are the most promising, 2020, the nation is under the threat of losing its foundation, that is, freedom for all, with a recognition of a providential God that made it all possible. We're reminded that while people will say peace and peace, but there really is that the reality is there is no peace. This is playing out in our generation, and we now are calling violence a peaceful violence. Only the Lord who can will bring peace to the world at the expense of the rebels who will be violently removed at his coming. Violently removed at his coming. He will kill them. Well, returning to Noah's curse, the incident did not occur in the shadows of Noah's ark, as some may think. Can you see the ark? And then we have over here Noah planted his vineyard, and then we have the sun. It all happened, you know, sort of in our backyard. That's not how it happened. So it was the first exploratory expedition, which lasted 150 years. After 190 years into this, we get to the southern end of the Arabian Peninsula in today's Yemen. And you see where I have the ark at the top. That's where we had Mount Ararat when we did it the last lesson. And we have Ham cursed down in the bottom. Now, you can sort of check your time here, because between each one of these settlements are marking, not really settlements, they weren't big enough to settle, but they're big enough to mark off zones. And I think this is where I need to have more time. Think about it. I think where these are marked, you go out from them. That is where they end up being in the world. Not sure completely that's always true. So you go around, you go one, and you got two, and you got three in Canaan, the land of Palestine. Then you have 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So you can count 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 years before this happened, when this curse occurred, 90 years after the flood, measured by those 10-year intervals. So everything is methodical. You know, they didn't say, well, let's see, you think we should go on now, Mrs. Noah? Well, no, let's stay here for a few more 10 years. Now, this is organized, and they went out to accomplish a mission, and so you can set the clock by these things, more or less. So we have this, 90 years after the flood, and on the southern peninsula, we now call it Yemen. And they crossed over the Red Sea into Africa, and they came back up and ended up back in the Palestine area. I don't know if I should say this now to confuse you or me, but we see number 3 over here. Hard to read that. But that's going to be Ham's settlement. And one of Ham's children is named after that land. Are you ahead of me? Canaan. The land of Canaan. That's where he was. Now, there's some problems with this, for Ham and Canaan, but interesting that the first time around, Ham goes there. In the end, it's called Canaan. Okay. So the first 150 years after the flood, the family moved together, not having enough population to settle territories. The first expedition was to scope out and zone territories for all 8 members of the Ark. Size of the family after the 150 years, I just sort of get a population calculator, and I pegged it at 2% like it was 1970. Now it's way down in even our country. In some of the world, it's under 2%, which means they won't survive. So after these 150 years at 2% growth, they generated from 8 to 160. If your population grows at 4%, there would have been 3,000. If the population growth would have been quadrupled at 8, the generation would be 1.3 million after 150 years. So somewhere between there is probably the right number. 2% is too low, 4% maybe still too low, because they had multiple children here quickly, I would have guessed. So in the Noah's Ark lesson, this is back to my little chart here, in my Noah's Ark lesson, we identified Mount Ararat, where the Ark settled in the headwaters at the Tigris River. It almost seemed like the beginning, the very, very beginning of the river. Up on the hill, that's where the Noah's Ark seems to be, because there's a nice big flat plateau up there. So the first expedition must have followed the Tigris River, makes sense, down the water, on a general circuitous loop from east to west, down as far as southern Arabia, Yemen had that, and then into Africa, and then back into the present-day Israel. And I've noticed already number 3 was Ham's territory. The Canaanites left their mark there, and I'll show that a little bit because it factors in on the curse. So we have Ham, and we have Cush and Mizraim, Put and Hannah. That's how it's in the Bible. And so we're going to look at this. We're in Genesis 5:29, and this is the curse. Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be to his brothers. He also said, negative. Now he says, blessed, positive. Blessed be the Lord, this is a Yahweh word here, and God El Yelamon of Shem. And let Canaan be a servant, let God El Yelamon enlarge Japheth, benefit to Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem. Japheth is going to benefit from Shem. Let the Canaan be his servant. Now, that's very hard to understand that, so I made you a picture. Not yet, I guess one more here. So I got to repeat this, make sure we understand what's going on here. The question asked here is, since Ham was the offending party, why did God not curse him? You know the answer now. But cursing Ham would have taken 1/3 out of the plan for a population settlement. This Noah could ill afford to change a core element. So summary, the original plan was to populate with these sons. Cursing Ham would have changed that plan. So he did the next best thing he could, which was, of course, to curse his son, Canaan. And so he said, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be to his brothers. It's a gentle curse. Now, how this was carried out, he or they shall be slaves to his brothers. By the way, they're slaves, not servants, as you have in your Bibles generally. Everybody's so afraid of the word slave that we don't even use it in the Bible, but it's the word slave. They shall be slaves to his brothers. We also see a blessing and a taking. And he also said, blessed be the Lord, the Yahweh, God of Elohim, of Shem, and let Canaan be a servant. I read this to you already. Part two, may God, Elohim, enlarge Japheth, let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be a servant. All right, probably didn't need that, did that once already. So here's my little diagram. So we have reviewing our own only Canaan stock. Now, stock is people, groups, families. You know, I always talk the stock were those people, those guys that were in the feedlot that we'd fed corn to. Those are our stock, but these are people stock. Other family members are not included in the schematic, just the curse aspect. So the parties involved, of course, are Noah, Ham, Japheth, and Shem. And when we start out, we have Ham as an Elohimist. And I would say this a little later on, that all of these eight people on the ark are identify, I don't know how else to say this, probably as a priestess or a priest to God by a name that we recognize, like Elohim or a Yahweh. And we have all these others, El Shaddai, all these other words. All right, so they're priests to this God. Now we think, wait a minute, they're not 10 gods. I know that. And I think they knew it, but they were tied to their God by the name they gave him or how they worshiped him. And so that name almost became a commodity that you could trade or take or steal or assign. And that's going to happen here, and it will be claimed by Melchizedek at the end. So we have Noah, we have Ham, he's an Elohimist, and he has Canadian stock, that's his children. We have Japheth and his children. And then we have Shem, and we have that he is a Yahwist priesthood. So the curse now is going to upset this apple cart. So how does it get upset? Well, first of all, that Canaan stock goes to Shem, and with him goes the Elohim, the priest of Elohim goes with him, and leaves Ham without that. Now, we say, well, that doesn't seem too serious. Well, I don't know. It must be serious because this is something they was really upset about. Okay, so that's the first step. The next step, now that Ham has been deprived of his stock, we have to replenish him. So Japheth sends some of his stock over to him. All right? Now, nothing goes there with the divine. And these become known as Hamites. And I told you before that the pyramids, the great big pyramids, the famous pyramids of Egypt, were built by Japheth's sons in somewhat Ham's territory. Now you understand why. Those stock people were sent over there. So they were so well entrenched with them that it became known as Hamites, although their real extraction was from Japheth. All right, now Japheth sits with his basket empty. So how was Japheth compensated? We do not know if he was. Or there's one more possibility, I think, that trying to read between the lines. So now we have Shem actually controls two stocks. He controls Shem, and he controls Japheth. He's taken from Ham, so the important people, shall we say, are under Shem and Japheth. Ham is left out, sort of like in a cold. Now, interesting, which I don't know what has anything to do with, but there is such thing as sibyl rivalry, and Shem and Japheth have the same parents, same mother. Ham is born from a different woman. Now, that could set up a problem. You know, always have three people. Somebody's got to be the odd man out. So they have common parentage, and there's a blessing here yet. So Shem now controls or is dominant or protects Japheth. He lives in the tent of Shem. That's how it says. So it's like Shem enlarges his tent and includes Japheth. So now we have a unified, shall we say, the right side, and then we have Ham on the wrong side. And that's sort of the division that's set up with the curse. And that's the division that's set up at the Tower of Babel, and that's the division we see today. Okay, so it goes back to these days. So I think I'm not going to read that again because I've told you that. So the first 150 years 10 years in each place. These zones are chosen for the 8 ark people and the 7 additional children that were born to Noah after the flood. So that makes 15. And if you count, we have 15 spots. And they go in this order. Noah goes first, and Japheth and Ham, number 3, remember, he's in the land of Canaan. And then we have Shem, then Uma. I lost the 6 here. Oh, that's Madavi? Yeah. These are, okay, pink are the ladies. I'm cute. And in my charts, the blue are the boys. That's right. So we have, I'm going to read all these names to you because they're hard to read. And so that gives us our 15. And we find that 2 children are born of each of these, shall I call them extra mothers, and 1 is born from one of the mothers. That's a yellow-skinned person. These are all, by the way, they're all color-coordinated. They all have colors, and that's where these colors come from. Okay, now some things of background to keep in mind how we work through this to recognize that absolute authority, the absolute authority Noah yields on the family. Now, I say absolute authority, but there's trouble. But Noah does control the thing, more or less, because we did actually get the job done. Later, there will be councils of the elites, 154 members of these people I just mentioned to you, and some of their children. But now in the early trial run at settlement, Noah's word is the law. So there's a family, there's family-wide support of Noah's endeavor, even though there's this difficulty. The family recognized together and family functions together and recognized the curses and blessings as obeyed orders. You can obey but not agree. You know, I think that's a little bit what's going on with Ham at least. The second thing is that the highest value in this civilization, and it is probably what it should be, are the people known for their linguistic stock. One thing we do, that's also another mistake, is that everybody spoke the same language at Noah's time. It's not right. In fact, their linguistic stock probably could have come through the mothers because of Noah's family, Noah the father. The 3 boys grew up in the family, so they probably would have known one thing. They could have known 2 languages because the mother was not of the same stock. So we have people here known by their linguistic stock, and they become genetic markers. We don't function that way at all. But if you think about it, your language is the most identifiable feature about you as a person. It's not your skin color. It's not your gray hair or your age. But if you find a group of people that you speak, that speak the same language with, regardless of who they are, you will be friends with them. So this is something we don't recognize. So the linguistic markers here tied to the genetic markers are very, very powerful. And as I said, they can be traded. They just did it with Canaan. Canaan said, I don't know how many there were. Says, you gang, you families, how many they are, 200, 400, whatever they are, you pick up and you go over there and you live with that guy or you submit to him. Live here, but submit to him, whatever, however they did that. So became part of Shem's authority. So these people are identified by their genetic family stock, but more importantly by their language. Their linguistic stock would be a unifying group as a family. And we dare suggest that racial differences accompany the linguistic groups as well. Their language identifies the name of God they serve. That's another thing that's interesting about this. We have, I said, 8 names for God out of these 8 parties on the boat. Ham was an Elohimist, but Noah took that form from him and gave it to Shem. Had that little diagram, they slid him around. Give it to Shem. And by the way, Melchizedek, I think is Shem, claims that when he gives Abraham the blessing. So Shem claimed it as a blessing for him, just said that. In the curse, linguistic stock became tradable. In other words, slaves. New American Standard has servants here, but the word is slave. Let's get over it. Point 3, baked into the system from the first is absolute necessity for order and unity to accomplish the assignments. And I'm supposing here that not to repeat the chaos of the antediluvian world. All would remember that. At least 8 people would have remembered that. It's the one thing we don't want to do, ever go back to that. We'll do anything besides go back to that chaos. So to some extent, they obey Noah to some extent. Even the cursings and the blessing of Noah followed the Hamite sin. Had to be honored, or accepted and honored. Yet the resentment that it fostered will raise its ugly head in the Tower of Babel incident 88 years later. So discord is by the very descendants of the offended Ham family who will lead the way to the rebellion. And I say so much for unity and harmony. Okay, so 150 years, settlements every 30 years. The Noah Council, fit for elites, met to determine the next 30 years of the regime. It's interesting they do that. You know, I didn't know they had committees back in those days. Permanent settlements were along, now we're talking different than that big loop. Now we're talking about along the Tigris-Euphrates River. And these that you see marked out here, are some of them are current cities, some of them are ancient cities. Permanent settlements were along the Mesopotamia rivers, one for each of the primary Noahic families. And we have those 30 years. I'm a little mixed up on whether they did it every 30 years. Some places did it every 30 years. Sometimes they did this in 30 years. So I guess I'm not sure which I'm saying here. Seemed like too quick to do it in 30 years. And these are the cities. You can look this up on any map, and you see these cities still are marked there, and I won't read them all to you, but they're each represented one of the families on the ark. The ladies had theirs too. One of the things that we don't want to see here, that the ladies had no power in those days. They were just like, you know, housewives, and that's the same kind of, you know, thing. They don't have any authority or any push or any power in the world, in the settlement. That's not true, according to this theory. And it sort of goes along with Noah's old grandfather in white slippers with a long beard, you know, blessing the little children. That's not true either. So we have some very, very strong people here establishing very, very important zones that will populate the world. So Ham's faction, 7 years into the era, deposed Noah. Ham actually attacks Noah, not physically, I don't think, but he deposes him from his position. And his arch enemy Sidon, son of Cush, grandson of Noah, acquired the identity of the city deity at Edru, a city founded by Noah. So there is a definite attack on Noah's position and to some extent succeeds. So Sidon proceeds to create a lie which damaged the account of Noahic origins ever since. And I think that's Pilkey saying that. I'm not sure how all this works out, but we certainly don't know a lot about Noah, and maybe that damage, because what Sidon did, he took the narrative and put it on himself. Well, that would confuse everybody. The Egyptian kids did that. Egyptian pharaohs did that. Now we have it been done here. So Sidon proceeds to create a lie about Noah, which damaged the account of Noah's origins ever since. Sidon created an image of himself, supplanting Noah and the virtual creator of the world. He wasn't just happy to be the flood, you know, god, so to speak. He also wanted to be the creator god, so he had great ambitions. And by the way, in these narratives, flood narratives, a lot of these things really are confused because they also talk about the creation at the same time of the flood. And of course, that's messed up, but you can understand how it could get messed up. So Sidon, in every culture, emerges as the mastermind behind the Gentile world order and its idolatrous version of Noah's theocracy. So Sidon and Noah's are in competition. And we'll end it with Sidon and Abraham and so on. Events to cope with in this next era we have, and we're not going to deal with these, but these are the things. We have the Tower of Babel within 21 years. We have the Uruk-Arada War, which is impossible to figure out, in another 36 years. And the Empire of Sargon, now Sargon builds his own empire, in another 58 years. During this time, the Japheth authority overall was stressed by the Noahic Council. Efforts to establish this totality on the Nile went on as it was going on in the Mesopotamia. So we have this chart, and I wish I could really explain to you, but I can't. So we have one side, we have Sidon, and we had, what's the other word I had here? Sargon. On that side, and we have Japheth on the Nile, and I said this about the Japheth's descendants built the pyramids. And so how'd they get over there? Well, that's just part of their development here. All right, so Japheth's job is to colonize the Nile. Solomon is challenging the whole world order by building an empire in Mesopotamia to unseat Japheth, his authority over the Nile. That's the conflict. Now, Nimrod is born 41 years after Ham and Canaan incident, but he is resentful or just, don't know this, just ambitious, strikes out without Noah, who is deposed, ostensibly for some kind of mistake he made, and it's something to do with the order of settlement was wrong or something like that. And I wonder, well, there might have been more to it than that. So Babylon, founded in 2340, is the abortive city we know about. It was Ham's idea to establish a unified world order. Important. That's what he tried to do. By a centralized government and a unified language. That's what he tried to do. All this is represented in the tower, establishing control of heaven as its objective. He wanted to supplant God. So we leave the tower incident there. We'll see if we get to it anymore or not. And I talked about the priesthoods, the various names of God, or names for God's qualities, are used by different language stocks. So religious authority was given to the 8 Noach family members who had various priests. Remember, they had priests then. Go-betweens. Example, priests of Elion, like he is one. It is hard to know when the priesthoods were developed or assigned, but in their dispersion at first, the true God is known by different realities. One each for the 8 Noach member stock members. So I went through this, and I gave you most of the names, Elohim, Yahweh, Elyon, El Olam, El Shaddai, El Gibor. I couldn't find that one. I have them somewhere. I just didn't have time to dig them up. And 2 more. All of these are known by us as describing the same God, just a different character of the God or role he plays or whatever. The God Redeemer, that's Yahweh. So by design or by default, they're God. That is, to understand him, was associated with nature, such as with wind, heaven, wisdom, sun, moon, hunter, shepherd, so on. It is understandable that God, who is sovereign over all in his names, various aspects of his life are assigned to him. Various aspects of life are assigned to him. So it would be a small step, you know, is the God of nature? And we don't say, of course. Was God the God of the wind? Well, of course, you see. So we're on a road there, but it's easily to be tripped up on, isn't it? So it'd be a small step to disassociate the living God from the wind, ending up with a God of the wind, small g, or a pagan God in its expression. The sun God being the dominant in nature assumes the highest of the pantheons of God. So it gets connected, you know, to that. It started out, you know, probably admirable. So then we had a lot of time, we'd go through all of these, but we have Elohim, we have the Semitic stock, the God of the wind, and we move on over, and then we go further down, we find that these are the Galileon, the Altec, the Mongols, the Turks, the Koreans, and is the God of heaven, El Olam, Sumerian, Uralic, the Finns, parts of Russia, then we have the Sino, the God El Shaddai, Chinese, and God of the moon. So we have all these, all of a sudden these names now are associated with these foreign language groups or peoples that we know about. So the names follow their lands without correction or who is being referred to. You know, they take the corrupted form and take it. So they become pagan since the true connection is lost. So we have Blessed be God, Elion of Shem, Melchizedek, son of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of God Elion, Most High, and he blessed him and said, Blessed be Abram of God Elion, Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. So there's Shem is, or Melchizedek is claiming the Elion. Well, of course, he got it from Canaan. We saw it earlier. So he's just reiterating that to Abraham. So blessed be the God Elion, Most High. Then Abram said to the king of Sodom after this war, I have sworn to the Lord Yahweh, God Elion, Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. I will not take any of the stuff from my enemy because I don't want you to think that he made me rich. So Melchizedek claims the title lost by the Hamites in the Canaan earth. Now this is a little while ago, not terrible, a couple hundred years ago. And Abraham, on the other hand, is blessed by the unifying names or powers of God by a priest that serves the Elion. So Abraham pledges to king of Sodom, I have sworn to the Lord, Yahweh, God Elion, Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. So Abraham now has acquired the blessing of Yahweh. So Yahweh will become the dominant name in Jewish history. We know him today that way. Okay, so longevity is one of the implications of long lifespans is to view these ancients as supernatural in light of their descendants' lifespans. The descendants lived short lives compared to their ancestors. So what kind of status would the world confer on Martin Luther, for example, that is now 500 years later, or John Calvin or Henry VIII, who would not view them as supernatural, having avoided death. It says death is, you know, coming on all people, but here's some people that don't are not subject to it. So it needs to think, well, they'll never die because they never have died yet, and they lived, you know, beyond 20 generations, and they haven't died yet. So if my lifespan is reduced to, say, 100 years, then how would I view these ancients? How would I view those ancients? How would I view Martin Luther? Well, conceivably in time, they would be considered gods, you know, special people for something, or at least supernatural something. They appeared supernatural. They did not die. They had superior ancient knowledge, and they bore an authority unparalleled in their children. So why are these not gods? Or are they not supernatural people? So we assume four generations in 100 years, there would be 20 generations looking up to Martin Luther. So once supernatural qualities are assigned to the ancients, it was easy to place them in the pantheons of God in subsequent generations where they remained. The gods do not die. After 500 years, no one would ever heard that they believed died or that believed that they did. So add to this the moral reaction to the ancients, the corrupting influence resident in the fallen nature. It was easy to forget the Creator God and live by the gods. They were known by different names, all traceable to the original and nearby subsequent generations of Noah's as priests of this fairy god. Therefore, these gods were not imagined out of thin air, but have concrete human analogies in our Bible. This phenomenon is called euhemerism. Acknowledging at first men's supernatural lifespan, long living mortals who at first appear to be gods and then begin to be gods, the major ancient cultures have the gods living at the top of a mountain. They come down to act with people as people. The gods have the same human foibles, all reminiscent of Noah and the descendants from Mount Ararat. Bilkey says this, the design of the Olympian Greece, 12 gods, suggests that it is data of the first rather than the second kind. In other words, they borrowed it from somebody else. So the Olympians borrowed it from somebody else. Well, that will be Noah. So by Noahic standards, it is loosely enough constructed to represent a political sect of patriarchs immigrating under duress from the heartland. The general outline of the Hellenic Greek pantheon, despite all its contradictions based on varied local traditions, is easy to recognize as Noahic. The chief titans are the four sons of Ham, Cush, and Nimrod. We have those mirroring Canaan, Chorus, and two sons, Poseidon and Hades, match the names of Canaan's first two sons. So there you go. That's how this is done. I just did one for you, but this is how it's done again and again and again. But Shem outlived most of them and shared in a number of them, appearing as these names in their national dynasty of the first Kish. This is after 150 years. And we have these names given all to Shem. And then we find that he is actually Melchizedek of the late Abrahamic period of Genesis. The New Testament Greek word for truth is Aletheia, means the unforgotten or that which must not be forgotten. The Apostle Peter brings this concept of truth to bear on the argument in 2 Peter 3, where a lawless indifference to the future return of Christ is traced up from a sinful exercise in forgetting what must not be forgotten. The argument of the chapter begins with the motive to stir up your pure minds by way of remembrance, as though the power to remember was an ethical principle, you did it on purpose, to form a righteous behavior. The author then warns that the advent of the generation of scoffers who would reject the return of Christ by cultivating a certain attitude towards history, namely that all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. In other words, these skeptics prefer a type of uniformitarianism of the past and refuse to believe in the reality of the past. So dispensational revolution such as the flood. The author traces this mistaken interpretation of history from the intellectual behavior problem, a willful disbelief in the biblical concept of origins. So the Christian historian cannot tolerate this policy. He must receive whatever evidence exists as a providential invitation to exercise one's memory as fully as the facts will allow. And that's where I am. It seems that we have to do this. Faith moves us to try hard as we can to remember the great revolution of the flood and to treat this revolution as foundational for a general interpretation of history. And it's true. You don't have the flood in your history. You have trouble with understanding it. Jacob Bryant, I mentioned him earlier, and Alexander Hislop, I mentioned him earlier, understand perfectly well that the names listed in Genesis 10 constitute such an invitation. The Genesis names constitute such an invitation, as profound and intense a scientific challenge as Christians have ever faced. A word of ancient names, tribal names, God's names, king's names, lie dormant at the feet of Noahic history, waiting to be synthesized through identification with the names listed here in his book. So as he said, the task can be done well, poorly, but it must be done. I guess that's what we're doing here, getting the ball rolling.